Welcome to Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, where we talk about gospel insights through great stories and help you find entertainment that is both true and beautiful. Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree is part of the Public Square Media network of podcasts that seek to bring an LDS perspective into the public square. I'm your host, Carl Cranny. I have a PhD in religion, and I enjoy writing on the intersection of religious themes in pop culture. And we have a wonderful panel today. Joining us, of course, is my co-host, Liz. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Liz Busby. I am a writer of science fiction and fantasy, a reviewer of books, and a Latter-day Saint.
And Glenn, could you introduce yourself, please?
Hi, thanks for having me. Yes, I'm a writer. I have about 30 books. I've had a few New York Times bestsellers in my day. And I'm the co-founder of the Center for Latter-day Saint Arts.
And David, if you can introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is David Sandu. Thank you for having me on. I have a couch and a TV, and that's about as much qualifications as I bring compared to you guys.
It's all good. That's fine enough. So today we're going to be talking about Darren Aronofsky's new film, The Whale. Brendan Fraser received Best Actor Academy Award for his performance as an overweight English teacher who is estranged from his daughter. The film is rated R, so we wanted to give a note of caution to our more sensitive audience members. Make sure you read about the film's content to help decide whether this film is right for you. But first, we're going to do our best books segment where we each recommend one thing we are watching, reading, or listening to. And I'll start us off. I have been enjoying The Mandalorian Season 3 so far, and the reason I bring it up is because there are some interesting religious overtones to this season, because our main character has been excommunicated from his particular sect of Mandalorians and has to go bathe ritually in the waters of the mines of Mandalore to be readmitted to the sect. And other Mandalorians think he's a little crazy for agreeing to join this, what they call a cult, but it means a lot to him. And so there's just some interesting stuff going on. I have enjoyed that they're taking his beliefs seriously, even though there are other people in the universe that do not take them seriously. But I also wanted to give a shout out in this most recent episode to our friend Ahmed Best, who was the actor who played Jar Jar Binks in the prequel trilogy. I'm here for all of what Star Wars is doing these days to redeem actors who had terrible runs in the prequel trilogy by bringing back Hayden Christensen as Darth Vader and a little bit of a flashback as Anakin. And now Ahmed Best, who was Jar Jar, and now got to play a pretty awesome Jedi Knight in some flashbacks to the fall of the Jedi Order and the execution of Order 66, because I am one of those people who believes the borderline conspiracy theory that Jar Jar was supposed to be the Master Sith Lord in the prequel trilogy, but George Lucas chickened out when everybody got so mad at him because Jar Jar was just a silly, annoying, racist Jamaican caricature. And there is a YouTube video that I'm going to make Liz put in the show notes that outlines why they think Jar Jar was supposed to be the Sith Master. And I watched that video and I have believed it 100% since then. So I'm glad they hired him to play an awesome Jedi for just the flashbacks. Like, I'm here for the redemption of all these actors who got panned for their work in the prequel trilogy, which, again, is not their fault. If George Lucas is trying to tell you to act like a wooden plank or a racist Jamaican caricature, you do it and collect your paycheck. So The Mandalorian, because of the religious overtones, but also this week because my boy Ahmed Best is back, and it was amazing. It was fun. So anyway.
I'm so excited about that because I really was so sad at the way they left season two. They didn't follow up on the religious issues. And so I'm excited that they are taking it seriously in season three. Thrilled.
And so, Liz, what have you been reading that you'd like to recommend to our listeners this session?
Okay. I finally read Heike's Void by Stephen Peck. It's been on my TBR since it came out last year. And wow. Oh my gosh. I did not know that Mormon literature could be like this. It's very readable and yet very deep and engaging and revolutionary. I stayed up past my bedtime a couple times reading it. It's from BCC Press. But if your experience of Mormon literature is Deseret Book, this is a different level. Nephi is a character in it, and he's struggling with some issues being the guardian angel to this not great soldier. And there's also some serial killer stuff going on in there, and some amnesia and lots of questions of the atonement, and is compelling and deep and fascinating. More people need to read it. Please read this book.
David, what do you have to recommend to our listeners this podcast episode?
Yeah, so I don't know if a lot of people will be into this, but I'm listening to a book on Audible right now, and I've really been enjoying it. It's called Becoming an Abolitionist, Police Protests and the Pursuit of Freedom by Derica Purnell. And it's this really fascinating half memoir, half essay, just detailing out history of policing and race in this country. And it just has a lot of interesting points. And it really drives home this idea of working on a society and being better with each other in our community so that we could live in a world where we didn't need policing in the same way that we do today. And it's just it sounds really heavy, and it is heavy, but it's actually a very uplifting book. And I've been really enjoying listening to it, at least. I can't say that I've actually been reading it.
Oh, it totally counts. It totally counts.
Yes, I'm 100%. If you listen to a book on Audible, that you can put that on your Goodreads list for this year. Absolutely.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Yes.
We're all for becoming a more perfect union here at Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree.
Indeed we are.
Glenn, what do you have to recommend to our listeners this podcast episode?
Well, yours sound amazing. I'm going to get busy right now. I was recommended to watch a film from Vietnam that I caught on Amazon. It's on Amazon Prime Video now, called The Brilliant Darkness. It's by LDS filmmakers living in Vietnam. So Aaron Toronto is the director and co-writer of the script with his wife, Nhao Nguyen, who won Best Actress for this role. So it won the equivalent of the Oscar for Best Film, Best Screenplay, and Best Actress. And it's a knockout of a movie. It's about a family that's disintegrating in a 24-hour period. It's their grandfather, who's the wealthy man of the family, dies. And so they're having this funeral celebration. And the family doesn't know, but his son, the father of the kids, and that grandfather of the other kids were in there. It's a four-generation film. They don't know that he's gambled away all of their inheritance, and they're going to be penniless. And the mob is after him, and they're going to kill him by morning if he doesn't come up with $150,000. In Hollywood, that would be the setup for a comedy. But this is quite a gorgeous tragedy, and it has to deal with mental illness and physical abuse of children, which is rampant in Vietnamese culture. And it's also autobiographical regarding that mental illness part. And so the film came out to great reviews last year and huge box office for Vietnam. And it won all these awards. And it's so influential politically that laws have been enacted to protect children. 2/3 of all people in Vietnam, according to recent statistics, say that they have been abused at the hands of their parents. So this is quite an issue. And so it's an issue film, but it's also very dramatic, and it's gorgeously lit and filmed. And because it's also LDS filmmakers, I just love that part of it too. So it's called The Brilliant Darkness.
Wow, Liz, we might need to put that on our list to do later this season. Wow, that sounds like one that I definitely want to sink my teeth into. We will have links to all of these recommendations on our website, popcultureapricottree.com. Buying through these links helps support our podcast so we can keep bringing you conversations about the true and the beautiful in pop culture. We also wanted to shout out a recent episode from one of our fellow LDS podcasts. Tribe of Testimonies is an amazing podcast run by Andrea Hales. She is a Native American from the Navajo tribe, and she felt compelled to begin interviewing other Native American Latter-day Saints. There are now 114 episodes, so hashtag podcast goals for us here. And each one is an interview with a different Latter-day Saint Native American. And the best words I can come up with to describe this podcast is oral history. Andrea is doing great work collecting stories and testimonies from some of our Native American brothers and sisters. And I heartily recommend the podcast. If you want somewhere to jump in, obviously you can just start at the beginning. But episode 101 is the one where Andrea herself is interviewed by one of her friends who was a former guest on the podcast. So Tribe of Testimonies is our Latter-day Saint podcast recommendation. And with that, now on to our main discussion of The Whale. So I got to say, I recommended this to the podcast after merely having watched the trailer, because there is this scene where Brendan Fraser's character just cries out, "I want to just know that I did one thing right in my life." And I watched that, just went, wow, there was just so much to that moment in the trailer. And I really like Darren Aronofsky. I've sung his praises before about his work on The Fountain, which is a very Buddhist film about death and dying and letting go. We talked about his version of the Noah story earlier in the podcast. Certainly something worth chewing on and engaging. This seemed really compelling and interesting to me. And as I was watching it, it became obvious to me that this is in some ways a film actually about Mormonism. The original play has a Latter-day Saint congregation off screen and a Latter-day Saint missionary as one of the main characters. In this film version, it's an evangelical congregation and an evangelical missionary. But my main takeaway from all of this is that, like, Under the Banner of Heaven, we called it ex-Mormon fan fiction and borderline anti-Mormon film. And this, the play seems like it was in that same vein, but because it is now given to us through the lens of this Jewish director who does such a marvelous job of making everybody like a very three-dimensional character instead of one-dimensional caricatures, I really enjoyed large swaths of this movie. Don't know if I completely agree with all of the sort of theses of the movie, but there's some really heavy and good stuff here. I'm reminded of a quote I heard from Ian McKellen, who said that one day he hoped to be as good a movie actor as Brendan Fraser. And I think this movie showcases why Ian McKellen looks up to Brendan Fraser as a film actor. So those are sort of my high-level thoughts. I'm curious what other people's high-level thoughts are about the movie and maybe the play and its intersection and translation from one medium to the other and all those things.
I love Aronofsky. I have enjoyed every movie I've watched with him. I will say that I think that The Whale might be my least favorite so far. I do enjoy it. That's not to say I don't like it. It's just I've enjoyed some of the other ones. It does feel like, I don't know if anybody here has seen The Wrestler, but this is basically The Wrestler. And The Wrestler might be a better version of this. But in terms of religion, I do think that this one has shoehorned some religion into it. I do think that the Elder Thomas character is more interesting in the play version than in this one. But I do think that the dialogue for the missionary is odd in that I don't think that a missionary actually talks that way. And if they did, I think I would be very frustrated if they were my companion. But I did think that this movie was interesting. And I think that it brings to light some criticism that I think that Christians, theists, LDS members do need to grapple with at some point.
Well, maybe it would be good to give a little bit of a plot of the movie. So this is a very hermetic little movie, leaves the apartment where the main character is in for about 3 seconds. But Charlie is a man in the play. He's described as from 500 to 600 pounds. He's largely entombed in this apartment. He teaches English writing online. He is divorced. He has a daughter. He's trying to reconnect with her after nearly a decade apart. His ex-wife got full custody. When he abandoned the family, when he fell in love with a student who is a man, this man named Alan ends up committing suicide before the movie starts. And in reaction to that, this character, Charlie, just spins out of control. Alan's sister is a nurse, and she's basically Charlie's only friend. And then there's this missionary who comes into the very beginning of the movie, chances on him, really. And he becomes a kind of a presence to try to save him, but also a catalyst for some things that happen. So that's basically the plot of the movie. And then at the end of the thing, the playwright and a screenwriter here, Samuel Lee Hunter, and in a lot of his works, there's a kind of a mystical thing that happens at the end of them. This film is no different. This man who's completely bound to his chair and his couch and his walker then rises off the ground. You see his feet dangle and then the screen goes white. And so it's his death, but he's also been transformed.
I was not sure about this film. Like, I liked the trailer as well. And then I started reading about the film. And I was like, oh no, what did we get ourselves into? And I had to split up my watching of the film over 2 nights because mom of kids. I am a wimp now and can't stay up late.
Unless you're reading Heike's Void.
Unless I'm reading Heike's Void. But so I watched the first hour and I was like, wow, this is depressing. This is going to be tough to get through. And the second hour is pretty equally tough. It's not till that last 10, 15 minutes of the film that we start getting some movement and some redemption. It really is like deathbed redemption is the name of the game in this movie, which is interesting. But did I like the film? I don't know. I was like, I'm going to need to talk about that with some people before I know if I recommend it. It's one of those movies that you can't just watch it and go, that was great. I'm done and move on with your life. You need to think about it and talk about it with people, I feel like, in order to process it, because it doesn't do a lot of that work for you. It gives you the events and then you need to work on, are these good people? Are they redeemable people? Do you like these people? Do you believe that they've become better people by the end of the film and that this redemption has worked? Yeah, it's a tough film, but it was a good film, I think.
It was interesting to me to see it being weirdly autobiographical in that I was a Latter-day Saint missionary who at one point was assigned to bring the sacrament to somebody who was bedridden because she had gained so much weight. And So Elder Thomas coming in to see Charlie and hanging out with him, I was like, oh, but it certainly, I think, plays a little bit on our thought of, are all these people who have failed each other so much? Charlie failing his ex-wife, possibly, although this failure would have happened off screen, to his former boyfriend, certainly his daughter.
Even the friend who's the caretaker, and she finds out that he has $120,000, and she's been like trekking through the snow to buy groceries for him when her car broke down, when he could have paid to fix the car. And like, that betrayal almost hurt me the worst. Like, when you're serving someone and then you find out they actually didn't need your help and they could have done it and they're just using you. It was very hard to watch that scene in particular, I think.
So she's in this situation because she feels like she failed her brother, who was his former boyfriend and who committed suicide. And so again, maybe that failure happened off screen, but Charlie's ex-wife, played by Samantha Morton, she's only in the movie for 5 or 10 minutes, but I always love everything Samantha Morton does, whether she's a 16-foot-tall green alien and John Carter or one of the precogs from Minority Report. She's always doing really interesting stuff. She's only there for 10 minutes, but even she feels like she's failed Charlie, even though Charlie walked out on her. All these people have just done all these really terrible, bad things to each other. And yet the film still, I think, really tries to make the point. I'm going to put this in more Christian religious terms. Like, they're all still children of God. They're all still people who are made in the image of God and who are worthy of love and empathy and redemption and all of those things that we could give them. But ooh, what a bunch of stuff to wade through to get there, though. Let's just hit some themes here really quick. One of the themes seems to be religion and the effects that it has on people for good or ill. I think mostly for ill in this movie, even though a lot of that happens off screen with the evangelical church who rejected this particular person because he came out as gay, leading to, it's implied, to his suicide, even though he was still reading the Bible and the Bible's still there. Just wanted to get some people's thoughts on Darren Aronofsky channeling Samuel D. Hunter's thoughts on religion and the negative roles it can play in our lives. I don't know. David, I know you had some thoughts you wanted to bring
it's
in
hard.
On that.
It's a tough one because it's a tough one to see yourself in the more Christian character and then to be like, oh, but I don't want to see myself necessarily there. I think that when I was thinking about the Thomas character, and this will maybe get into the larger aspects of what Aronofsky is trying to say. When I think about the Thomas character, I think that he was so focused in on a number of trying to get a baptism or to save somebody, whether or not that was sincere or not, that he missed the opportunity to just love somebody. And I think what Liz does really well, and Hong Chau, I think, gives possibly my favorite performance in this movie. One of my favorite scenes was that scene where she was just lying on him watching TV, and she just treated him like her brother. And I think that as a missionary, as a representative of Christ, we should be looking to just love people and to help them where they are and meet them where they're at and not try to drag them kicking and screaming into the font. And I felt like when I'm thinking of examples, that's where the missionary missed the mark. And I think that's where people of faith sometimes miss the mark. It was a very cynical way to talk about it, but I think that Ellie's description of people joining religion was not fictional. It's something that is realistic. I have the quote of, I'll tell you one thing I like about religion. What I like about religion is that it assumes everyone is an idiot and that they're incapable of saving themselves. I think they may have gotten something right there. I'm saying that I appreciate how religion makes people realize that. I appreciate that. But what I don't like about religion is that once people accept Jesus or whatever, they think they're more enlightened than everyone else. By accepting the fact that they are stupid sinners, they've become better than everyone else and they turn into a-holes. That's such a harsh criticism. But I think that there are people who have been affected in ways so negatively in the wake of religion. I won't even just say Christianity, but that rings true to some people. And I think that it's a tough thing to grapple with when we have to take accountability for how our religion can harm people sometimes.
Yeah, I think it can be hard to watch a film like this as a religious person and be like, this missionary is such a caricature. And you find out the missionary has his own problems. And so I did like the missionary better in the second half of the film when you find out what that he's struggling on his own thing. He's not just this self-righteous jerk. But it can be hard to watch that as a member of religion and be like, this is not all we are, but it is often the only portrayal we get in popular media is like the judgmental people who push people away and cause problems for the LGBTQ community. But while I would like to see some more portrayals of other aspects of religion, I think it is a valid thing that has been an experience for many people. And it is important for us as members of religion to consider that and think about that. And I like your point that Liz is the one who's there day in and day out taking care of this person.
When at one point, Ellie, the daughter, asks this missionary, "Are you Mormon?" And Thomas says, "No, I'm from New Life." There are many churches in the U.S. that have New Life as part of their name. So I don't think they're going for a specific church here. But I did think they wanted to be clear that they're distancing some from the Mormonness of the play. Four major drivers of this story are from that religion. Liz hasn't gone to church since she was 12, but was raised in it. Her father was the leader of the congregation who started a lot of this going on when he rejected his gay son, Alan. And then, of course, you have the missionary himself. So there's quite a lot of nuances there, really. It's not all religions painted with the same brush here. There are people who started in it, are not in it. Even the Thomas guy messed up. It's not really as cookie cutter as it might sound if you're just like reading a quick description of it. I don't know if that's pleasing to us, but on the other hand, I don't really go to movies or read books to find friends. I don't think of them as people, they're characters, and I don't really need to like everybody. In fact, I find that I get more insight from people who challenge me, and oh, this is a challenging film in lots of ways. I think the director really wants us to feel uncomfortable for almost 2 hours, starting with the environment, and we're trying to imagine ourselves as a 600-pound person and all of that. So I think they're onto some stuff as far as the challenging the audience part that I think is valuable.
I think that's the focus and through line of Aronofsky's work, really. When you think of A Requiem for a Dream or Noah or Mother or The Wrestler or this, he's constantly putting and displaying broken, unlikable people and asking the question, should they be redeemed? Is there redemption for these people, whether in this life or the next? It's a simple question, but it's a hard one emotionally for us to grapple with, because we want to say, yeah, everybody's redeemable. Everybody should be loved. And then you're put in those positions to try to love people, and you're like, really hard to love them. And then you're worried about how your own contributions to their life, and you're like wondering, am I making the right contribution here? I think what Brendan Fraser's character, Charlie, is so interesting is that despite all of that, he's not really a negative person. He's internalized that negativity to a way where he's slowly committing suicide, but he wants to see the good in people, and he wants to so desperately see maybe something good in him. He's internalized shame. And I think that there's a lot of nuance to that and commentary on maybe not necessarily Mormonism, but just it's not an accident that this is taking place in Idaho, in northern Idaho, which doesn't have the greatest track record of the friendliest people and the best version of religion out there.
David, what I'd say to that is the screenwriter is from Idaho, and all of his plays are set in Idaho. Almost all of them have religious characters in them. I find them not to be takedowns of religion. He certainly has strong feelings about them, but they're all over the map. They're quite nuanced. I think one of his curiosities generally is what is the relationship with contemporary life and religion? And I think he sees it as complex. And my guess is that Aronofsky, I don't know when he came across this play, that's a little over a decade old, but it probably completely connected with the things that he's interested in as a filmmaker that you discussed with earlier films.
I was just going to make the comment that Aronofsky is himself an atheist who grew up with a Jewish background, but I find his study and his just traveling around religion and different religions, it's very fascinating to me. And I do find that there is a sincerity there that could be taken as really negative, but I do think that there is a sincere hope to understand people's religions, whether or not they have positive or negative influences.
I love the ending of the missionary Thomas's storyline, where Charlie's daughter sends these incriminating photos and the recording of his confession of stealing the money from the mission and wasting it all and being trapped several states away and too embarrassed to come home. And she tracks down his parents and sends this to him, thinking, we're not told what she's thinking. Charlie interprets it as she's trying to save him. I personally think she was trying to ruin his life because that seems to be her self-destructive mode. And then his parents contact him and say, it's just money. Come home. And huh, that got me. And then Thomas says, isn't that the worst thing you've ever heard? Isn't that just awful? They want to actually forgive me. And that's just crazy. That kind of forgiveness is something that the other characters in the show are reaching for. We're trying to figure out, how can Ellie forgive her father who abandoned her at age 8? How can Charlie forgive himself? One of the most moving scenes for me also was the scene where Charlie is just on an eating rampage. I think it's fair to describe it that way. As someone who has some emotional eating things myself, like I felt that so hard where he's just destructively going through his kitchen and eating absolutely everything and doesn't care what it is, just trying to punish himself for what he has done to his family, to his daughter. And just, it was heartbreaking. And seeing that inability of him to forgive himself, he's kept himself in isolation all these years and not tried to fix anything because he couldn't forgive himself.
That scene is really hard to watch for anybody like, you know, me, who's had a lot of family members deal with these issues. It's triggered by this new character that's not in the play, the pizza delivery man, who has a really sweet relationship with Charlie. He reaches out and wants to, even though he's never seen him, reaches out and wants to know that he's okay, keeps asking about it. Are you sure you're okay? And then once he sees him and is disgusted by him, that's a word that appears several times in this film, disgust. Then that gets Charlie going on a real binge there.
It's so sad. Yeah. It's just so, like, you hoped for one good person. Not that anybody is necessarily bad except for Ellie, who was a complete sociopath. It's just, you hope that this Dan guy has been nice, this pizza delivery guy, and then he sees him. If that scene and when his students see him for the first time at the end, and then you see them, like, pull up their phones and start taking pictures of him, and they have this disgusted look. And it's a real cynical view. And I would hope that's not the how people would really react. But today I was driving on the highway and there was a car accident on the other side of the highway. And we had traffic on our end because everybody had to stop and stare, right? We have this innate thing to just be drawn and stare at something that is out of the norm. And that gut punch reaction is just, it's sad. And it's just, why do we do this to each other?
I'm interested in the contrast between we feel terrible for all these people who react to Charlie as this disgusting thing. And yet Charlie's whole mantra for his writing class and as he's trying to teach Ellie how to write is be honest, have a freaking opinion about something, like care, say the truth. And yet the truth is also really harmful sometimes. So how do we reconcile those two things, right? How do we say what is true and yet acknowledge that sometimes saying the truth is maybe the worst thing you could do? You shouldn't.
I think about the difference between how he kept pushing Thomas, do I disgust, do I make you grossed out? And Thomas would not admit that he was actually repulsed by Charlie. But then when you hear Liz talk, she just talks openly. Yeah, you're fat. And she says, I got a fat person wheelchair for you. And she's open about it in a way where Charlie realizes that he is obese. He realizes that he's a big man. That's not hidden. So why are you pretending not to have a reaction to him? I think he appreciated Ellie's reactions to him in some ways because he knew that she was just being honest. And then you can work past it. Honesty, whether it's going to be a situation that's difficult or not, you're going to have a moment where it is hurtful and it is painful. But at least you can then start to grapple with it and live with it rather than pushing it away in the corner, pretending like it's not there.
So what do you make of it? What do you make of Liz, this nurse? She's enabling, bringing all this food, and she probably feels really guilty because her brother, who has died, but what do you make of that relationship between those two?
And it's interesting because her brother died from suicide, but implies in the dialogue that he also had an eating disorder, but the opposite, like he was more anorexic than binge eater the way Charlie is. And so she's not only enabling, but she's also compensating for this previous failure of hers. And there's a moment, especially right after he almost chokes and she has to go over, and there's no way you're going to perform the Heimlich maneuver on somebody who weighs that much with a body like that. And it's a really scary, genuinely frightening moment for her. And yet at the end of it, she's like, well, do you still want the meatball sandwich with extra cheese that I got you? And she offers it to him kind of like, do you still want to do this? And Charlie's response is, yeah, I guess I still want to eat the sandwich, even though it just nearly killed me and freaked you out. And so she's a really complicated character. And I appreciated the layer and depth of all of that.
We see that in real life, right? Like when you have a child, a parent, a sibling who is self-destructive, who is struggling with real life, what do you do? Because there's only so much you can do, especially once they are an adult, to force them to make good choices. At some point, you cannot force right. them to. Something personal to me is my dad has two brothers who are homeless by choice, who live off the grid, don't trust the government, and have psychiatric issues that they refuse to seek treatment for. And there's only so much that you can do sometimes for people. You can do what you can when they're there, and that's it. Sometimes I feel like Liz was in that kind of hard place, right? Where she cares about Charlie and she wants him to have the best life he can. And she wishes he would do more, but she can't make him. She can't. And so she's chosen that she's going to be caring, even though she thinks he's being self-destructive.
The structure of the film is a countdown to his death. It's a daily thing. Each day has a title on the screen there. And I think that impending doom, which everybody knows about, all the characters in this play are counting down to, I think it affects the way that they're treating him, that maybe it's beyond hope in some cases. I'm sorry to hear that, Liz, about your family. My closest friend in high school died yesterday. And life is really, really messed up. And I think movies like this, that are just this quest for redemption, and also ask of the audience, break out your compassion here to supplant judgment, I think are really quite wonderful. I mean, there are problems with this movie. I don't think anybody is going to say this is a brilliant film. If we were rewriting the play today, I don't think he would write it this way either. But I think it has a lot to say for itself.
I run residential homes for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And what specifically I run is individuals who are more difficult than average individuals. And so we have to really support them in a lot of different ways. And there are ways that are really, some are very destructive. And we have to walk this fine line as caretakers to always honor their rights, never stand in the way what their rights are, but to also encourage them to do something that is more productive. And sometimes we don't win those battles. And that can be really hard emotionally. And it's really hard because you're really wanting to look out for the safety of these individuals. And it's one of those things where it's, listen, this is going to happen no matter what. All we can do is to be there and to teach them and to be with them more and more. If that means I am called an enabler at times, then that's what I'm going to be, in order so that I can be there to continually support them. And I don't see Liz as an enabler in this. I think that he could have ordered food. He could have gone to Uber Eats. He could have kept just getting other food deliveries. At least this way, she can still be part and help him. And she was able to make positive changes in his life, knowing that at the end of the day, all she was doing was just making him comfortable as he laid himself down to die.
As sad as these characters are, and maybe it's just because I'm old, I've known people like every single one of these characters, like without exception, every single one. I don't know what to make of that other than just to say, but I don't know what my circle is.
They're real. They're real people.
That's why I enjoyed the movie's critique of religion, even though it was aimed at least tangentially against my religion, because I felt like these were all real people who I felt were three-dimensional and didn't slide into stereotypes or caricatures very much, at least as the movie unfolds. So I like that they're all really interesting and well-rounded and shows so much the way we affect each other. I think the key part of that for me watching this movie was Charlie's relationship with Ellie and the damage that he has done to her and his desperate attempt to find some redemption in that relationship and in her life, even though I don't think this is going to end well, because she is a deeply disturbed teenager now, partially because her dad abandoned her family 10 years ago. There's not a lot that we know about the rest of her life, but it's pretty heavily implied by her dialogue that this is what has damaged her so much. And he's going to try to repair the relationship by talking to her the last week he dies and then dumping $120,000 in her lap right as she turns 18. And I don't think this is like a good long-term parenting strategy to abandon your child for a decade, just reconnect right before you die on your literally deathbed repentance, and then drop like $100,000 in their lap and just hope that it works out. Because she is a deeply cynical person. Charlie fell in love and followed his heart and lived his truth. We've talked about like people's truth here. And one of the things I really liked about this is that it shows that you can live your truth. That's a big thing. A lot of people in our culture are trying to say you can do, live your authentic life. But sometimes it has some really serious negative connotations. And that was no more obvious to me than in that particular relationship. So I like other people's thoughts on the Charlie and Ellie dynamic. I'm giving it away. Like the way I view their relationship, his thoughts that, oh, she's actually really a good person. Look at this good thing that happened because she was like taking mean pictures of people and posting it on her Facebook feed. I think that Charlie's deluded himself a little bit, but I'm happy to have been proved wrong if any of you have different thoughts.
Well, I'll jump in first. I think what you're describing is how Ellie sees things before she realizes what really has gone on. Charlie's ex fought and got full custody. Charlie's continually tried to help, but hasn't been able to speak to her. He's tried to find out a little bit of what she's doing, and mom will occasionally give him a little bit of information, but the mom has some alcoholic issues as well. So there's some troubles going on in their life. He's doing financial support. It's more than just child support. It's whatever you need, he says at one point to his wife in her crucial scene. I'm curious if these were actual people, and now Ellie's aware of all of these things, if her life does change because of this, if she does become more of the person that Charlie imagines. At one point, when she's really angry about abandonment, and she says, how could you abandon me? And he says, Ellie, look at me. Who would want me to be a part of their life? That was, for me, one of the saddest moments of the movie. So I'm not really to assign all of the blame on this guy. I don't know. I think I'm less skeptical about Ellie than you three might seem, but I'm kind of rooting for her.
There's so many factors that to play in there, right? I think if Charlie had been maybe in a society or in a place where he could have always lived his authentic life, the situation would have never occurred. He wouldn't have felt that he would have had to hide in the closet and gone into a mixed orientation marriage to begin with, possibly. That's just me taking a look at what we're seeing nowadays. And it reminds me of Grace and Frankie on Netflix. It's basically a modern day Golden Girls in a lot of ways. But the central premise of that show is that Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin, their husbands, Sam Waterston and Martin Sheen, have been working as law partners for years. And then they end up leaving their wives in their elderly state and get married to each other to live their life. And there's a line that I love that Jane Fonda said in there. She goes, I want to be so mad at you for leaving me and having this affair, but I feel like I'm not allowed to because you're living your authentic life now. And I think that this movie goes into that. The movie like addresses these harmful things that I think societally we have created opportunities for things like this to happen. And there are all sorts of people in the world who are suffering because of stuff like this. When I was in Utah, I was a manager of a home. And when the leaving manager, I was a brand new manager and I was meeting my new clients. And the manager took me aside and he goes, I'm going to tell you about this one individual. This individual was gay and was struggling with a lot of other things. And he goes, I think that this individual is evil. I think that he's actually wicked and he is just nothing but trouble. And I hated that. And so I went in and I told all my staff, if this is the way that you think, then you can leave. And everybody quit. And it was just me and one other staff. And then we built up a new team and I told everybody, listen, this individual's not evil. Maybe they've made some mistakes in their life, but we're going to love them. And in the 4 years I was there, he excelled and he did much better. I wonder, there's that moment where the mom, when she says she's evil, like I had a flashback to that. And not to put all the blame on her because she was struggling as well, But it would be so interesting if Charlie had been around, he could have been that counterweight. But I do think that sometimes we put labels on people and then we have a hard time seeing past them and past those labels. And then they're going to personify that. And I think that maybe, Glenn, I liked what you said, like maybe that last act of love, he walked towards her. He said that she was wonderful. He said it was beautiful with his last words. And then he gave her money, an opportunity to have a start. Maybe she'll blow it all. Maybe she will. Or maybe, just maybe, that planted the seed. Let's go back to Alma 32, that plants that seed that maybe she'll be able to let that grow and work through the trauma that she's had to go through.
So I'm going to tie this back into C.S. Lewis, as I do. I was listening to a podcast about C.S. Lewis's essay on forgiveness and thinking about it in relation to this movie. And they talked about there's three levels of forgiveness. We have excusing behavior. We can say it's not your fault. It's the society around you. It's the way people have treated you. And you had no choice but to act this way. And then there's also treating what people do as inexcusable. In spite of your circumstances, you had a choice and you made this choice. And we can see that's the way Ellie feels about her dad. Like, no matter your circumstances, you weren't in my life, and that is inexcusable. And then the third level is the one the Savior wants us to be at that says, yeah, your behavior could be inexcusable, and I forgive you. And that's where you can move on. Because regardless of the things that are excusable and the things that are inexcusable, we are asked to forgive. And that's the part of this movie that I've found to really work for me is that it shows you these very flawed people in very terrible circumstances who've made choices that are not great. And yet it says, can you forgive them? Can they forgive each other? And can we get to somewhere better because of that? And for that reason, it felt like a movie that is almost about the atonement. About this power that we have when we choose to forgive other people despite them not deserving it in any way.
Are all of your episodes this emotional and deep?
Just me. Let me tell you, I wrote a letter to my fifth grade teacher explaining that I would cry in class, and it's continued on for the rest of my life.
It's also, I think, a testament, Liz, to you that you are a better person than I am because I see all of that. And yet, I still want to say, Charlie, you blew it. And I can see, like, in the context of these people, and this is obviously not the worldview of Mr. Hunter or Mr. Aronofsky, but, like, when we talked in our episode on Midnight Mass, and Jennifer Roach talked about how we put so much weight on victims of abuse to be able to just hurry up and forgive. We can get to that part. And we don't realize that there has to be some serious healing first, like, I believe that someday Ellie and Charlie could have a good relationship, but it's going to take both of them being healed through the atonement in the afterlife before I think that would really kick in.
Certainly a week is not enough time.
We recognize that the play and the movie are working on certain temporal constraints that the atonement does not operate under, but you are a much more kind and forgiving person. I just want to look at Charlie and be like, all right, like you lived your life and you made all these terrible choices. And at the very end, you decided you wanted to change them. You should have made that choice 300 pounds ago or back when you were deciding whether or not to leave your family to live your truth or at any of these things. And you see the redemption still possible for someone like that. And I do, but for me, it's more academic. And maybe that's because I am a worse person than you are.
Oh, I was listening to this podcast because there is a person who I'm struggling to forgive. So it is something I think we have to choose over and over. It is nuts. It's one and done.
Fair enough. I love all of these comments. And Liz, I think I want you as my next door neighbor is what I want. I don't think you can get through this movie unless you're willing to wrestle with the idea of compassion. I don't think you... Like Carl, you're talking about this litany of mistakes that he's made. It's true, but I have very close friends who are in the process of doing what he's doing right now. And so I find it difficult to really be too tough on Charlie because I recognize these friends that I love in him. I think there's a difference between critical thinking and judgmental thinking. I think I'm wired to be a critical person, but what I've decided is I don't have to judge anybody. Like, even with a film, like I can dislike a film without disliking the people who made it because I dislike the film, right? So I like this distinction between critical and judgmental.
Sure, that's fair. And if Charlie were my next door neighbor, I probably wouldn't feel that bad about. There's a distance that the movie creates as a person watching it that maybe allows me to be meaner than I would hope I would be in real life, as somebody who has, of the four of us, literally had this experience as a Mormon missionary going into somebody who we were, I guess, technically enablers, because they were, this woman was so overweight, she couldn't order food for herself. This was before cell phones and things like that. If she was going to get food, people like us had to bring it to her, and we brought her food that was not super helpful, but we did it. And I don't know what to think about myself then, but
service of love. Service and love doesn't have to be the pyramid of food and everything. It doesn't have to always be perfect.
It's reminding me of the end of the last season of The Good Place, where they're like, look at this. There are no good choices. Every choice has bad things, and there are no perfect choices. Yeah, if we hold ourselves up to the standard of, I need to make the perfect choice and it will fix this person, that's never going to happen.
We could take a look at Christ's life, and he never asked follow-up questions. Here, what's going to happen after I heal you from leprosy? He went around and he just healed people and he just gave out service, whether or not that would bring them to the gospel or not, and did things that may be enabling. A person who's been a leper for years and years are not going to have any skills. So afterwards, what's going to happen with them? If you've ever seen Life of Brian, there's that moment where the guy goes, I'm an ex-leper, money for an ex-leper. I have no skills. Some guy comes and just heals me, and now I just have to live here as an ex-leper. It's funny, but like, there's some truth to that. I think the other thing that we have to consider with Charlie dealt with just as much trauma as everybody else. It was different, but he has horrible trauma that we would never wish upon any person that has led him to the point where he kills himself. This is a suicide, and it's a suicide note.
Yeah.
And we just get to see it in slow motion.
The food aspect makes it really difficult to talk about. If I had a next door neighbor who was an alcoholic and he wanted me to go buy booze, I don't think I would do it. But on the other hand, I probably would do it. But on the other hand, a guy in my family was almost in Charlie's physical state in the hospital, telling his family, you can't come visit me unless you bring me candy, right before he died of obesity related issues. So I don't know how comfortable any of us is talking about overeating and in a compulsive way, the same way that we would talk about drug and alcohol abuse. Although how many films are there of drug and alcohol abuse that are like really intense? This film got a fair amount of flack for the way that it was handling. Aronofsky got into a little bit of trouble. The way that he was showcasing the binge eating was salacious and over the top. So I think one of the interesting things about the movie is that it's trying to move the needle a little bit in the conversation generally about the issues that are specific to it.
Wasn't there an Aronofsky one after Pi?
Requiem of a Dream. That one is about drug use, and it was a very intense movie. That actually, to speak in more technical terms of a film, most films have something like, I don't know, let's just say 3,000 edits. That movie has almost like 7,000 edits or something, to make it so that you have that feeling of what it's like to be on drugs and that intensity. If you think about that scene where he binge eats, a bunch of quick edits, right? And so he goes back to, oh, I've done this. If you watch his films, he's making a clear distinction that he's also making a movie about addiction, and there's no difference between this and Requiem for a Dream.
One quick one about the translation from the play to the movie. We talked about the changes regarding religion, but there's another significant one. So the whale represents lots of things. It's Ahab's whale of Moby Dick. It's also this person. But in the play, it's also Jonah and the whale. So in the play, the lover, Alan, is lured back to church one final time by his father, who's the bishop of the ward, and who calls him and says, can you come just one more time? I'm going to give a talk. And the reason in the play that Charlie asks the missionary back to come to his house isn't anything to do with preaching. It's because he thinks he'll have access to find out what happened that day. And it turns out that talk was on Jonah and the whale, which was the thing that spiraled this Alan toward his own suicide. So I think the movie we were talking about, where we remove LDS characters, is that in some kind of deference or fear or audience building? I don't think really it's any of those things. I think the Jonah and the whale part wasn't as strong. I think removing it is cleaner. I don't think that the play probably really makes all that much sense. There's not really a lot of connection in the play between Moby Dick's whale and Jonah and the whale. So I think it's just a little bit stronger.
I will say, though, that I did like what Charlie's response to that afterwards, because Charlie kept thinking, What happened that day? What happened that day that Alan comes home and is distraught for the rest of his life and then eventually kills himself? And he thought that it was some sort of homophobic hell and damnation speech that his father gave. And it was just a story of Jonah and the whale, and he was almost disappointed. There was one part that I wanted to bring up, too, that was a difference in the play than the movie. They actually talk about the Book of Mormon in the play. And there's a specific part where Charlie is talking about, he finds the Book of Mormon devastating. He says that there's the story with Sherem and how he gets struck down, and in his dying words, he testifies of Christ and then dies. And he goes, God just killed him to make a point. And he's like, I find that devastating. I can't help but find that there's, and I don't know what to do with this, but there's some sort of parallel happening here as well, that in his last moments, he's trying to do the right thing. Sherem was doing it, whatever was causing it. I don't think that this is a case of God was striking Charlie down by any means, but it did feel like there was a parallel, and I don't know exactly what to do with that. And I'm not sure that Hunter was trying to come up with something either for that, but it did ring interesting to me. I would have almost liked to have seen that in the movie, because I would have been curious to see if Aronofsky would have played with that at all.
It would have been cool to see a mainstream film take the Book of Mormon as a serious thing and not a joke. So that would have been cool.
We can allow Mr. Hunter his second draft of the play, and it sounds like the movie version is stronger in a couple of places by some of these changes that he's made.
We need to be relatively clear. The play hates the church. Charlie says he hates the church. But the interesting thing about that is it has meat behind it, unlike some of the recent things that we've seen on cable, because he's coming to it from a point of knowledge. Charlie in the play has read the Book of Mormon multiple times and is quoting from a very specific thing to imply that he really knows what he's talking about. And then the same thing happens in the movie where he says to Thomas, I read every tract that you people have ever written. He wants to make sure that the audience is aware that he's coming to it from a place of exposure. He just doesn't agree with it.
And I feel like that's so much more respectful. Like, I can't demand that everybody present my religion to be the best and most perfect version of my religion or to agree with it. But it's nice when people can disagree with it intelligently. I appreciate that.
Thank you, everybody, for all your comments. It's been good. And like I said, I did not realize it was going to be this kind of movie when I suggested it. And so I'm glad we've had a good discussion, and thank you all. But we will move on now to our ratings segment. We give each movie that we review three different ratings. The first is for content. We rate it according to the Latter-day Saint Afterlife, Celestial, Terrestrial, Telestial, or Outer Darkness. I'm just going to go ahead and say this is a very heavy movie. In a lot of ways, things like nudity, it's not really purient nudity in the way of Playboy or pornography or something, because it's just Charlie taking a shower. There's the scene at the very beginning where he's masturbating to gay porn, but that's really all there is for that. I'm going to say, though, overall, just as far as the content, because we separate this from the other ratings that we give it, I'm going to have to give this one an Outer Darkness for myself, like just not separating the artistic merit of the situation. This is rated R, and for good reason. There are just some things that we don't normally cover in this podcast. If there were lower kingdoms in the Telestial Kingdom, I'd give it the lowest of that, but I think I have to go with Outer Darkness.
Now see, I gotta totally disagree with you, Carl. When I found out this movie was rated R and read the description, I was expecting a lot more content than I felt like there was in this film. It is a heavy film. But I don't think it is, obviously not pornographic. There is a lot of language. That's yes. There's a lot of high emotions and a lot of language. But I feel like the language was more of the reason it was given the rated R than anything else in it. So I personally wouldn't put it in Outer Darkness. I would probably put it in, I don't know, Telestial, maybe Terrestrial. I just didn't feel like there was as much difficult content as I was expecting. I was bracing for it. And then I was like, that wasn't as bad as like the first 15 minutes led me to believe.
That's a hard one. So I like that it's a different rating system. I have a lot of problems with the MPAA. I think I'm going to agree more with you, Liz. I don't think that the language was actually gratuitous. I think that it was honest to these kind of situations. In my mission, I served in Nebraska. This was just daily, right? This is just the kind of interactions I had with people and the kind of language I heard all the time. I think that to take Charlie's opinion, we want some honesty, right? And if it was anything less, it'd be less than honest. And I think that that would be a disservice for anybody seeing a story like this with it being insulated. I won't give it a celestial, but I'll give it a terrestrial.
I respect all of those opinions, but I'm going to have to pass on your rating system. It's not really the way that I approach art. It's cool, and I'm ready to weigh in on the next category, but I'll skip this one.
That's fair. It's a weird rating system, and we recognize that it doesn't work perfectly well, but it is a way of encapsulating what's going on with the movie. So I can respect the pass. Our second rating is for artistic merit, and we give things a scale of 1 to 5 popcorn balls, 5 being amazing, and 1 being this was a junk movie that no thought or ever really went into it. And I'd be curious to see how people rate this one.
What was I looking at? Rotten Tomatoes. I think the Rotten Tomatoes scores is in the mid-60s or something for this movie. I liked it more than those people did. I would give it 4, but for its impact on me personally, I would even go higher. This hit me, and I think it was partially just because of my circumstances then.
David, what did you think?
I think if I'm just looking at this as a film, I'm going to go with 4 because I think that there was some really effective performances in here. I think the direction was good. I do think that some of the acting went a little too big for me, specifically in Sadie Sink, which I believe Glenn disagrees with me on that one. I think that the performances are good, but I think that her character and the performance went into parody at time for me. And so I can't give it a full 5 on that one. So 4.
I think I'm going to go with 4 as well. I felt like it's very immersive, and I'm always fascinated by films that take place in just one room. I think that's a cool thing to do, and it's harder than it looks. The one thing that threw me out as an English major is what 8th grade teacher is assigning them to read Moby Dick? Really? This is not happening. So, just saying.
Fair enough. Yeah. I think I'm going to land on 4 as well. I find the translation of play to film interesting. I think sometimes it works really well. And sometimes you're like, oh, this is a play that they turned into a movie. And this felt like that to me. And because that was obvious to me, I'm going to knock it down to 4. But I'm the one who disagrees with you, Glenn, on Sadie Sink's characterization of Ellie there and the way she plays that character. I bought into the moody, angsty teenager that has been severely damaged by these actions. And even though I'm rethinking that because of some of the ways you have all pushed back on me in this conversation, something still feels very authentic to me about just the things I've seen about children who are divorced. And I appreciated so much that the movie nuanced the idea that if you live your truth and you live your authentic life, it'll all be hugs and puppies and rainbows. Rainbows specifically in some corners of the community, but that has negative effects. And I don't know. I totally bought her. Aronofsky does really good work as the director, of course. Brendan Fraser, man, like, oh, wow, that was stunning. And so I think I'm going to give it 4.5, just rated a little higher than all of you, which maybe is interesting given our conversation about how it seems like the three of you liked the movie in some ways more than I did. But just artistically, it stuck with me, though, and in some ways was what I wanted from the movie. When I saw that trailer, I was like, oh, that looks really interesting to me. And it was. And so I'm going to give it 4.5.
It does sound like we won you over a little bit, Carl.
I still don't know where I am on the whole redemption thing with Liz. I don't know. I have to sort that out, see if I can maybe find my way to being what I think is a better person than what I currently am in my reaction to the character and the decisions he's made. Our final rating is 1 to 5 apricots, and that is Gospel Connections. And I have this ongoing feud with myself to not give something 5 apricots unless it has a really explicit gospel connection. And this one doesn't, but there was so much to think about and how we treat people and everybody being made in the image of God, despite all of our errors and the things we've done to each other and the things we've done to ourselves. We're still worthy of love and compassion and redemption. I'm going to give it 5 and lead off this part just by saying that it was a beautiful movie in some ways that is, as you are listening to me live, trying to confront some of the sins and the attitudes I have that are perhaps sinful in my own life. That means it's a great work of art. And I'm going to give it 5 apricots for the gospel connections. Liz, what did you give this one?
I feel the same about this film as you, that like it is one that makes you need to discuss and think. And so I think that's very valuable in art. I think there's a lot of us who approach entertainment as something to fill time and not to think about. And this is definitely on the opposite side of that spectrum, that this is not an easy answer, not an entertainment. It is a think kind of piece. I don't know if I would go quite as far as 5. I think I'll stick with 4 apricots for me.
David, what would you give this one on a scale of 1 to 5 apricots?
I think it's good to look in the darkness sometimes. I think it's good for us to really confront things that are left in the wake of religion in general. And I think that I would go with 5. And I think I would, one of the things that we didn't necessarily talk about, but one of the things that I think is important, especially when you take a look at the life of Christ, is the idea of chosen family. And that's something that's in here, and that can be difficult, right? We see that even Mary, the mother of Jesus, was pushed back at times by Christ in choosing a different family at times. And I think that here we have that. And I think that making choices, regardless of whatever, they're going to have consequences. And sometimes they'll have consequences that will hurt people, even when they are the right choice. And so I don't think that we should treat necessarily people's decisions that we may not fully understand, that don't maybe fall in line with the greater culture of our church, as different as when people may join the church and are completely estranged from their family as well. I mean, because we do see that on the other side as well, right?
Yeah.
And people in this world are making really difficult decisions. And this is a movie full of tough choices across the board. And I think to better grapple with those kinds of lessons of empathy and sympathy to live a more celestial life, I think that this kind of movie is good, because otherwise we live in a bubble where everything's flowers and unicorns. And reality is not that way, and we shouldn't insulate ourselves from the tough subjects.
Yeah. That might be the subtitle for our episode. Sometimes you need to stare into the darkness to live a celestial life. Glenn, bring us home. What would you give this on a scale of 1 to 5 apricots?
Well, I want you all to go to movies with me is what I want. This has been so much fun.
That's why you should subscribe to the podcast.
I listen. I'm not entirely a newbie. I listen. I'm a big fan of this and all things in life. I think I'm going to give it 4 stars. The thing that I loved about the movie that haunts me is at the very end, and he's finally talking to his daughter. She's actually listening, finally. And he says, "I couldn't ask for a more incredible daughter." And then right before that, there's a scene, I think it's to Liz, where he says, "People are incapable of not caring. People are amazing." And so you see this person and you feel, I don't know, it might not be disgust, but it's probably pity, or it's probably lots of complicated things. And here is this guy who has that kind of statement at the very end of his life, which I found quite profound. I think I would say 4 instead of 5, because there is an element of a distrust of religion. And I think he's being fair, he being the director as well as the screenwriter. But I think it's probably more accurate that he's talking about that culture that's also in Idaho, not just religious culture generally. Because where I live, I don't think religion is like that. I don't think the reactions are really like that. I think there's a tiny bit of an axe to grind that makes me slightly uncomfortable, if I'm going to be honest there. And if it were 5 stars for me, I would be really recommending it to everybody that I know who's LDS. And I'll probably stop short of that.
Sure. To end my personal apotheosis, as we had this discussion, your thought there, Glenn, because when Charlie says all of these things, I'm like, oh my gosh, you're being so naive. Like, you look at all these broken, you have broken this person, and you have done all these things, these other people, and they have broken you. And just, how can you be so optimistic? And now you have convinced me that that is the way that Jesus looks at everybody, and I need to repent. So there you go. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for this wonderful discussion. I have obviously been changed, and now I feel like I need to go watch the movie again and reevaluate my initial reaction to it, because I think it might have been incorrect in a couple of places, and I can ask for no better conversation partners than people who can change your mind. So thanks for joining us on Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree. You can find me on Twitter at Coral Cranny. Liz, where can people find you if they'd like to reach out?
You can follow my writing on lizbusby.com, and all my social media is linked on there.
And David, if people wanted to reach out and get in touch with you, could they find you?
I don't know if it'll still be around, but I do have a TikTok. Ema Sandu, and I'm actually going to be putting out a series in May on TikTok of Asian American heroes every day, since that's Asian American History Month.
Oh, fantastic.
Well, that's awesome.
I hope it's around so you can do that. Glenn, where could people find you if they wanted to reach out and get in touch?
I get emails almost every day from somebody in the church somewhere in the world. So I really love hearing from people. And they're often outside of the U.S., which I especially love. And so I'm just glenn.nelson.nyc@gmail. And I have a podcast called the Center Studio Podcast. Actually, our last episode was with these Vietnamese filmmakers that I referenced earlier. Today, it might be fun for people to listen to that.
It's a really interesting podcast. You find such cool people to talk to.
You just reach out. I'm not that friendly of a person. I don't know why people want to talk to me, but they seem to.
The magic of podcasting.
Liz, could you tell people what we're doing for our next episode on pop culture on the apricot tree?
Yes. Our next episode, we are going to be talking about Where the Crawdads Sing, which is a story about a young woman who's growing up in the marshes of North Carolina. And she deals with a lot of stuff. She's abandoned by her parents and overcomes that to become a naturalist. And then she also deals with sexual assault and some of the fallout from that. So if you're sensitive to that kind of content, you want to be careful with this one. It's not really explicit, but those are definitely triggering things for some people. And it's got a very interesting ending. So stay all the way to the end for that one and be ready for that conversation in 2 weeks.
Thanks, everybody, for joining us. This has been Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, encouraging you to seek after everything virtuous, lovely, of good report, or praiseworthy. See you next time.